Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Paul Madison has been Canada's High Commissioner to Australia for the past 3 years. Before that, he enjoyed a stellar three-decade career as a Canadian naval officer, capped off in 2011 when he was named Commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. Paul was through Ottawa recently and stopped by my office to talk about life in the Navy, his view of global affairs and its predecessors from the outside, and how his view has changed now that he's on the inside.
G'day, mate. It's Paul Madison. It's always, that's the best I go.
That's not bad.
It's always great to be with you. Paul is in town for just a couple of days. That's not an often occurrence when you are the Canadian High Commissioner in Australia. So thanks for making time to come by.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
You've been there about 3 years or going on 3 years.
Yeah.
It's tough to think of a country in the world with which Canada has a closer relationship. Mm. Before we get to that, though, I want to talk about your history. I learned, and for readers that don't know, Paul, before becoming High Commissioner in Canberra, was the head of the Canadian Navy. I learned recently that the current head of the Canadian Navy is from Tabor, Alberta, which is about as far from the ocean as you can get, and it's also very dry. Hmm. So I'm interested in your background and where you were born and how you ended up becoming a sailor.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here, and I'm here because you, during the Global Heads of Mission meeting, you talked about your podcasts and you
shamelessly promoting.
Yeah, and you invited us to come in. So I thought, here I am in Ottawa on a rare visit. So it's great to come in here and see you and talk and share some stories. So I was born in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. So, but I'm not a prairie guy. You know, my folks are both from Nova Scotia.
Okay.
And my father joined the Air Force, and so Moose Jaw is a Air Force base. Mm-hmm. I was born there. But to go back to what you said about Alberta and Vice Admiral Ron Lloyd, who's a current mm-hmm. commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. During the Second World War, the two cities in Canada that recruited the most sailors for Canada's Navy were Winnipeg and Calgary. So I think it was the attraction of farmers
of
who had never seen salt water.
Yeah. And perhaps people looking just to get out, right?
So my roots are really Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia. Yeah. And a military family, it sounds like.
That's correct. And so it was just kind of natural for me to enroll. I was in high school in Ottawa, and I attended Collège Militaire Royal de Saint-Jean in the late 70s, was commissioned in 1980, and then spent the next 33 years serving Canada sea and alongside.
So your Wikipedia entry on the sort of summary version on the right-hand side shows that you served in the Gulf War. Was that was an active combat mission?
Yes, it was. Although we didn't see any kinetics
right.
where we were operating in the Southern Arabian Gulf in 1990-1991, I was on watch and underway. I think it was the 16th of January or the 17th of January when the invasion began and the striking forces were launching all the Tomahawks that were flying up the coast of Iran and flying up the coast of Saudi Arabia and straight up the Gulf into Iraq. And that was that first conflict where people were able to sort of see it on CNN,
as you may recall.
It was a pretty extraordinary experience and a privilege to be serving in the Canadian task group.
Right. What are, as you look back at that 33 years, and you obviously had a stellar run and rise to become commander, I think named in 2011, so commander for your final stretch. What were your you have had some time to think about it now, and you're sitting in a different institution. What are your reflections on highlights, challenges, things that you wish had been different?
Well, you know, when you look at your career, it's in stages, and so the first several years were focused on being at sea. So the highlights were being part of high-performing teams, having to depend on one another, focusing on the mission and recognizing the strengths and weaknesses of each of the individuals in the team, and sort of training our way to serve at sea as best we could. And I think a highlight for me was taking command of HMCS Calgary in 1997. It was just I had never dreamed when I was a younger officer that I would have the opportunity to be given that kind of a privilege, and it just sort of happens. And that was a great ship, great crew. We did some amazing things.
Do you take it out and see how fast it'll go, or how do you have fun when you win your first command?
Well, you actually do some of that. I mean, the frigates were just being delivered in the 90s, and so we used to take leaders out,
right.
Folks like you,
yeah.
we to show what the Navy was capable of doing, and one of the things we would do is demonstrate high speed maneuvers, and it was a lot of fun. You go full speed ahead at 30 knots,
just
go full speed astern. Take that way off and then go full speed ahead again, and you'd feel 50,000 shaft horsepower actually vibrating through the deck plates and up through your legs. It was just, so we would do that kind of stuff.
That would involve long absences from family if you're at sea.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of the downside. I never anticipated as much sea time as I ended up getting, and so... when I think of my wife Faye and how much she had to sacrifice from her own personal life and her own aspirations and what she had to deal with as essentially a single mother for extended periods when the children were very small, I can't give her enough credit for what she did and I didn't even appreciate then how much I would end up asking of her. And I suppose if we ever were able to do it again and we knew what would follow, we probably would have made different choices.
Sure. And slightly different time back then, probably, in terms of expectations and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Navy that I joined is not the Navy that I left. And when I joined the Navy, when it came to spouses, I mean, if you had an issue at home... the senior folks would say, look, if the Queen wanted you to have a wife, she would have issued you with one. So the message that was being sent then was, your personal life is not our life.
Right.
You owe,
our concern either.
You owe all of your energy and allegiance to the Navy. And if you have personal issues, then you deal with them or you are a problem.
Right.
And so as the leadership changed in the Navy and that whole approach was transformed 180 degrees.
Right.
Until we got to a place where we were publicly talking about the strength behind the uniform being the family, and acknowledging that it's not just sailor soldiers, airmen and women who serve Canada and go in harm's way, but it's their entire family that is involved in enabling a man or woman to be able to voluntarily choose to serve.
Well,
and so, that's the arc that I saw through my career, and it's given me a great deal of satisfaction to see that we were able to lead that change.
I mean, there's a parallel to this department, as you well have figured out, because there was a time when officers were men and spouses were women who were expected to give up their careers. We have long talked about the fact that we post families. We don't just post the employee, right. and sometimes we're maybe not as good at walking that walk as the talk, but nonetheless, it is a reality that unless I very much like that, you know, behind the uniform, there's a family.
Yeah.
That's manifestly true in our shop as well. So you go on to become the commander. If you didn't expect even to be in command of a ship, that must have been quite something.
Yeah.
You retired in 2013 or 2014, and now you're back as a public servant. Tell me, you must have formed an impression of this department from across the city.
Yeah,
I'm interested in that. The two departments haven't always seen eye to eye.
Right.
Although I think it's probably much better than it used to be.
Yeah.
But what were your impressions coming into this shop and which ones have been borne out?
Okay. So, first of all, when you said retired in 2013, I failed spectacularly at retirement, and I've come to realize that you don't retire; you just transition to something better, and this turned out to be something, you know, better for me. In terms of impressions, as a junior officer in the 80s, I had the amazing experience of being an aide-de-camp to the Governor General of Canada. It was Madame Jeanne Sauvé, and so back then you had to live at Government House. And you traveled through all the state visits and the state visits that came to Canada. So we worked very closely with the chief of protocol and officials here, you know, around the presentation of letters of credence. You know, I remember coming here and picking up new ambassadors in the Landau and going up Sussex for the letters of credence. And so I formed an appreciation then of a very exciting, a very talented, very motivated, engaged group of professionals serving Canada in a different way. And when we traveled abroad, I remember state visits to Italy and the Vatican and Portugal and France and England, and you know, to see how the embassies supported the Governor General and how we had to work with them and the RCMP and the visit planning just gave me a very positive impression.
Mm.
And so that's one that I've carried with me through the rest of my career. You know, as we moved forward, you know, I remember when I was in command of Calgary, port visit in Manila, and I remember it very well because I co-hosted a reception with the ambassador to the Philippines. And I remember, I can't remember his name and I'm embarrassed, but this is 20 years ago, but he impressed me as such a nice, erudite, engaged, personal man who fully appreciated that a warship coming into his home port, so to speak, was a floating embassy, and he wanted to make full use of it, and he appreciated that a warship with a Canadian flag in a foreign port attracts influencers in a way that maybe they won't come to your residence or your office as easily. So we had ministers and senior influencers come down, and it was a pleasure to work with him, and he was very thankful, and it made me realize that even though we were in uniform and we were mostly focused on being operationally ready at sea, that in the Navy, at least, when we came alongside in a foreign port, we were actually an extension of the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were there to work with you to further the national interest. So that was a very positive experience. And then as I came up into the more strategic level, especially around the conflict in Afghanistan, that's when I found it really interesting observing in Ottawa how DFAT, or Global Affairs Canada, and DND we're working very closely together around the development, security, and governance triangle, which was really at the heart of the campaign plan in Afghanistan. And General Hillier was leading from the DND side with the deputy, and there was obviously a huge commitment from Global Affairs.
That's certainly the one that people point to
as having
made the change.
Yeah, and there were some teething pains, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was some cultural, I call it cultural dissonance, but by driving towards that whole of government approach, I think that set the tone for the for a significant
change.
As
I say, it's the one I think people point to when they think or talk about whole of government.
Yeah.
They tend to have somehow been associated with that because that was, I think it did mark the change. And in my relatively short time in my current position, I've had a whole new vista open to me that I never saw before. In the sort of the national security cluster of agencies that
right.
work exceptionally closely together, formally and informally. And of course, D&D and the Canadian Forces are very much part of that
yeah.
group. Australia
hmm.
might.
G'day, mate. How you doing? All right.
So... You know, the fewer countries are as close to Canada, you know, the number of times where somebody says, well, what do the Aussies do?
Hmm.
When one thinks of security cooperation, one thinks of Five Eyes, when one thinks of almost any challenge we're facing, it's always
yeah.
Useful to think about what our friends in Australia are doing. But what are the differences? Where have you seen very different approaches from Australia? They live in a rougher neighborhood
yeah.
than we do.
Yeah.
They live with a China reality that,
yeah.
that we don't experience as strongly. They have a different posture on immigration. Talk to us about not the similarities, but the differences.
Well, I think geography matters in this case. And so... Alan Gingell, who's a former secretary over at Foreign Affairs in Canberra, and wrote a book in 2015 called "Fear of Abandonment," and it's a history of Australian public policy, foreign policy since about 1942. And this fear of abandonment refers to the relationship first with the United Kingdom,
and then with
the United States,
yeah.
And so being an island continent in a very, what I would say it's the center of the vortex right mm. now, with Indonesia, Philippines, Southeast Asia up north, China, Japan, Korea, India to the west, there's a lot to keep them occupied strategically. And so they view their strategic alliances in, slightly differently than us. And so... I was actually surprised when I got there. It was during the lead up to the American election cycle. The degree to which I did not ever think that Australians would be as focused or even obsessed on the American political cycle as Canadians. But I found that they were at
sure.
least as engaged
sure.
As Canadians are. And so that made me really think. And
it started badly.
Yeah, it did. Well, after the election. But the strategic alliance is everything for them.
Right. Yeah.
And they like to say that they have two very close friends, that's China and the United States, but they only have one ally in that particular case. So the relationship with the United States, how they manage it, is as important as we do, but there are different elements at play here. Certainly not the same economic compelling imperative that Canada is facing, especially today with the the tariffs
and
NAFTA, et cetera. But then you turn that around with China. Their relationship with China is different. It's different than ours, as you alluded to, mm-hmm. because of the so much of their economic weight is in the relationship with China, the China Australia Free Trade Agreement, and the fact that Australia is the only G20 nation that has had continuous growth for now 28 consecutive
right.
years,
right.
and that is all a function. Of increasing Chinese commodities draw. And so I think, be careful what I say here, but I think the degree to which they have become very active with the Chinese on so many levels has forced them to be perhaps more strategically nimble in their China relationship than perhaps we are, and because they have to be. And so I think it's a very good file for Canada to continue to observe very closely.
Mm.
Migration, a very difficult file in Australia. They, like Canada, their strength is their diversity. You know, in Melbourne and Sydney, over 50% of the populations are born overseas. So, you know, Melbourne and Sydney arguably look a lot like Toronto and Vancouver and mm-hmm. Montreal. But like Canada, they are very much open to lawful and orderly, rules-based managed immigration. And Canada has not had the experience that they were forced to endure. And so it's led to the conditions.
Which was boatloads of people arriving.
So transnational criminal organizations running refugees or even economic
migrants
and on boats that ran into trouble on the top end of Australia, and hundreds of civilians drowned at sea, and the Australian government decided that this wasn't right, and they set the gears in motion to stop the boats. This became a government policy. It's very controversial. Mm. I'm sure that if the same kind of thing had happened in Canada, it would have been and continued to be equally controversial. And the fact that there are about 13 or 1,400 asylum seekers, refugees, and stateless people in offshore processing centers on Nauru and in Manus Island and PNG is a very hot button in Australia. Mm-hmm. And you know, thankfully, this is not something that Canada has to work through. But if you go back to the Sun Sea episode in 2010, I think it was, you know, that was a significant national event here, and that's only one boat.
Yeah, a very tough one. And the other thing about Australia's sort of neighborhood and where it sits as it looks north, that's always been intriguing to me, is its relationship with some of the islands, particularly its development assistance relationship, which is different from any relationship I can think of that Canada has, wherein I was out there once, and I was on the Solomon Islands, and the Australian High Commissioner said to me, no, David, you don't understand. We currently pay one-third of this country's healthcare budget, and we expect to be doing so forever. I mean, they really are sort of out there on their own, in their own sort of sphere of influence, and that seems to have broad, that approach to their island neighbors seems to have broad public support in Australia.
Absolutely, and in fact, it's currently a political wedge issue around whether they're engaging enough. Mm. I'll add that I'm accredited to seven Pacific Island countries, and my good friend Mary Obot in Wellington is accredited to another five. So this is very much a part of what we are doing. So I'm in Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Palau, Nauru, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. And Mario is in Fiji, Kiribati, Tuvalu, Tonga, and Samoa. Mm-hmm. And this is an important neighborhood in the world for a whole number of reasons.
You're here talking partly about APEC, right?
Yep. Yeah, so APEC and Papua New Guinea. And so to go back to your original question, Australia invests $600 million annually into Papua New Guinea alone. Mm-hmm. The interdependency of the relationship between Australia and Papua New Guinea is marked. Mm-hmm. I mean, Australia was essentially the colonial administrator up until independence in 1975, and so the legacy relationship is very strong, and you see it across the Pacific. The Australians consider the sort of the South and Western Pacific to be their backyard. The New Zealanders see, you know, the sort of the southern part of the Pacific to be their backyard, and they're doing all they can to, within reason, to build trust, to help build good governance, to bring an enduring development capacity around healthcare, especially enabling women and girls, and that's why around climate resilience, and that's why. High Commissioner Bott and I have been, successful in arguing that Canada's development priorities resonate very strongly in the South Pacific. Yeah. And
lots of, I've followed it for years, and lots of similarities except the question about where we work. Because in the case of Australia and New Zealand as well, it's pretty clear where their priorities are.
Right.
I would be remiss before I let you go if I didn't ask you to give us any reflections you will on leadership in the two main organizations you've served, the Canadian Forces, the Canadian Navy, and similarities, differences to the leadership requirements that you've seen in global affairs.
Thank you for the question, David. I'll say it's always about the people. It's never so much about the leader. I've always believed that if you genuinely spend time with the people in your mission or in your ship, if you sincerely show that you respect them for who you are, and if you make it very clear that that you believe that each and every individual on your team has a unique gift to bring to bear on enabling the mission to achieve success, and that that you're there to welcome that gift. It doesn't matter what role you have as a CBS LES, as a sailor, an officer, but it's a team effort, and nobody's successful unless we're all kind of successful. And if you're out there communicating and being visible and being supportive and following up and saying, thank you for what you just did there on your own initiative, it means a lot. And not being invisible, I think those things are very important. And being a champion for your folks. So when, sometimes it's difficult to get the strategic headquarters level to kind of recognize that some of the real human tensions or how as humans we're being impacted by budget challenges or by programmatic challenges, and so you need to, as a leader, step out and be their champion, and doing that in a respectful way is the key. I would say around a difference. So having commanded the Navy and having run a $2 billion budget and 15,000 people, I probably made a mistake in assuming that going into a mission in Canberra with 45 people, I could just take the leadership style I had then and just kind of apply it there. And I learned very quickly. So I was looking around and saying, we need to do this. I think we'll need to do that. I would like to see this happen. I very much would think we need to do this. And my deputy came to me about a month into the appointment, and he said, "Look, I really get what you're saying, and I agree with all of the important activity lines that you're opening. But if we're going to get any of this done, you need to do half of it yourself." Mm. And I had to make that switch.
Sure.
So
sure.
It doesn't matter if you're the High Commissioner or if you're leading a mission, a medium-sized or small to medium-sized mission like Canberra's, if you want to get anything done, you actually got to get down there and roll up your sleeves and muck around with the team.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed, making that switch. I've been told by the team there that I'm, more visible and more sort of out there communicating and talking and providing feedback than they might have been used to, and so I take that as as sort of a positive.
Yeah, we all, when we get thrust into different jobs, different situations, we learn more as leaders.
Yeah,
right. They, a new gig challenges old assumptions. Yeah. So,
and I've learned things every day. And I mean, I thought that the being in the military and having commanded at the strategic level, that I had a pretty broad understanding of the machinery of government and a pretty broad understanding of the governance, the global governance system, and where Canada's interests are engaged. But I again realized very early that I needed to understand the other aspects of what Global Affairs Canada is bringing around the world. And I had to rely upon on my team to bring me up to speed.
Back to teamwork with a good dose of communication. Paul,
yeah.
We could go on and on.
Yeah.
We're right out of time. So thank you. Travel back well, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Great chatting with you, David.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.